Every Woman is a feminist show about women making a difference and the men by their side. As 52% of eligible U.S. voters and 50% of the world's population, women are not a special interest group, and every woman should work and vote for nothing less than 50-50 participation in the social, political, economic, and environmental arenas. The views and opinions expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of the KKFI staff, management, sponsors, or board of KKFI and the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated. Good afternoon. This is Sharon Lockhart here in the studio with Ebony on the engineering board and intern Beth Wilkinson sitting behind her, looking over her shoulder, learning to operate the board. Amy Bell at the table here next to one of our guests, Jonathan Rudy from Elizabethtown College, a peacemaker in residence. We'll hear more from him later. And our first guest today is Jane McLean, co-founder, or founder, actually, of the Women's Wall of Achievement, and back for the fourth week to finish up a segment for Women's History Month on women running for president. And then toward the end of the show, we hope to have Women in Buddhism with Donna Wolf and Dorothy Hawkins joining us, and perhaps Jude LeClaire. But let's start now with Jane and finish up with the long road for women to run for president.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I did the same thing last week, or somebody else did it. Amy did it. It's Women's News first.
No problem. And let me say thank you for tuning in to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. And we will go ahead with the news for this week. Women working for Amazon.com Incorporated in the U.S. earn 99.9 cents for every dollar men earn doing the same jobs in 2015, the company said Wednesday, responding to activist investors pushing technology companies to close the gender pay gap. Amazon said it hired an independent labor economist to conduct the study, which was completed recently. At Amazon, we are committed to keeping compensation fair and equitable, the company said in a statement, adding that minority employees earn 100.1 cents for every dollar white employees in the same positions earned. Apple Incorporated and Intel Corporation reported earlier this year that their gender pay gap either is already closed or will be shortly. Bloomberg Business reported March 23rd. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau doesn't think it should be a big deal for a man to call himself a feminist. If you're a progressive, you really should be a feminist because it's about equality, it's about respect, it's about making the best of the world we have, he told Vox senior producer and correspondent Elizabeth Plank during the premiere episode of new Vox video series 2016-ish. Trudeau spoke about the way his wife, Sophie, reminds him to impress the importance of gender equality upon his sons just as much as his daughters. How are you training your sons to be focused on women's rights and women's opportunities the way you're focused on telling your daughter that she can be anything, Trudeau said. That, for me, was a really important wake-up, the Huffington Post reported March 25th. And, Amy, you have a bit of more news.
We had a really strange occurrence today that we had a news program that was so outrageous that we literally couldn't come to a consensus on how to report it professionally. we do collect our own news throughout the week. And this week there was the, tantrum that was had between Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. Where an ad went out that could only really be described as slut-shaming Donald Trump's wife, Melania. I'm not even sure how to pronounce her.
Melania, I think.
Mm-hmm. And it was a nude photo that she was in a photo shoot in GQ magazine in January of 2000. And Donald Trump responded by putting out some tweets and some memes threatening that he was going to release the truth about Heidi Cruz, and there were some memes that just showed a picture of Heidi Cruz's face next to Melania's face, mm-hmm. and basically was insinuating that Heidi Cruz was an ugly woman. It was so irrational and immature. We just couldn't let this go untalked about But it
needed to be said.
It was so unprofessional that I don't know how other news agencies are reporting on this with a straight face.
Well, what strikes me about it is that women are such easy targets to attack us for being sluts or being ugly or, you know, for not fitting a certain mold, a certain way. I mean, women have to be so perfect, you know.
And I think that might have been part of the problem in trying to write out a story to just report on this, is that I'm so annoyed that this is the way they talk about women that Ebony just kept going, Amy, that's not news. I'm like, it is news. But I was too angry about the way women are being represented mm-hmm. in this campaign, so it wasn't coming across as news. It was coming across as an opinion piece, but it is news. It happened.
Exactly.
So we just wanted to add that on to our news today and just how kind of outrageous it was that it was actually...
And this is 2016. Mm-hmm. And these are grown men.
And we literally couldn't come to an agreement on how to sound professional saying that. So
there you have it.
That's the news.
That's it. Now, back to Jane McLean with the Women in Presidency.
All right. One of the goals of the Wall of Women's Achievement is to weave women back into history and show their fundamental roles that they have played in some of the basic events in American history, and maybe this presidential campaign is one of those. But back to the two we talked about last week, Margaret Chase Smith, a Republican from Maine who ran for president in 1964, and Shirley Chisholm, a Democrat running from New York who ran for president in 1962. It turned out that these two...
Or 72.
72, thank yeah. You. Thank you. It turned out that these two women were the last women to actually get to a major Democratic or Republican national convention and they were nominated to be president, but they didn't win the nomination because they didn't have enough delegates. Then as more primaries came into being, it became more and more difficult for a woman to even reach the convention, and the conventions became almost a rubber stamp of who had won the primaries. So when people talk about Margaret Chase Smith and Shirley Chisholm paving the way for women to get the vote, it's probably not the right metaphor. Probably what these campaigns showed was the rocks or even the boulders that are in the middle of the road for them to get to the presidency. Mm. And the two key ones are, first of all, the belief that men are more suited for leadership and government positions than women. This is the way it's phrased to say men are superior to women. And money. The two are intertwined. Because as primaries became more costly, you had to have professional campaigners, you had to have TV ads, you had to have intensive travel, you had to have computers in your, et cetera, et cetera. And then there was always the question, is the candidate electable? Well, if you're not really suited for office, who's going to put money? So that some very experienced women foundered on the rock of money. One of them was Pat Schrader. She was an 8-term House of Representative member, very powerful within the House. She couldn't get enough money to get started in the 1988 campaign on the Democratic side. Then on the Republican side, Elizabeth Dole, in 2000, she was able to raise about $5 million. But her opponents, which were Stephen Forbes and George W. Bush, they outraced her 75-1 and 80-1. And Elizabeth Dole said, well, you know, I can do 2-1. I could even do 10-1, but I can't do 80-1. She bowed out early on. Carol Moseley Braun in 2004, the first African-American senator in the United States. Not the first African-American woman senator, the first African-American senator. Placed very low in the D.C. primary, which is highly African-American, and dropped out before the Iowa. So what has worked in paving the way for women to become president seems to be the growing number of women who have been elected to government have proved their competency, that they have the stamina, that they can go beyond being emotional, and that it doesn't matter whether they are trim and dress real exactly. Except we can come back to Hillary Clinton in 2008 and the pantsuit kind of controversy. Yeah.
I would like to jump in here, if okay. I may, because we are very aware of the double standard of talking about women's appearances when mm-hmm. they are the candidate or candidate's wives, as it was this week. So we thought it would be just kind of a laugh to do a weekly reporting on what the men were wearing on the campaign trail, like whose suit was Bernie Sanders wearing today? What tie is that, John Kasich? You know? And we can't find that information.
I'm not surprised. I know that one question I've thought is, why does Donald Trump wear his tie so long? It's well below his belt buckle. But nobody gives me the answer to that either.
The only report on what a candidate was actually wearing was a... there was one tongue-in-cheek Jezebel report where they were just kind of making fun of Ted Cruz not having a very good tailor. And there was one report in, I think, July of 2015 about Donald Trump showing up to a rally in a baseball cap.
But that's just baseball cap.
That was the only descriptor, was baseball cap. So, you know, we were going to report on, was this suit Versace, or, you know, just completely irrelevant information that they report on when it comes to women candidates. And you can get that information about Hillary Clinton. You can see who her suit is. There's a whole article about who the designer of the perfect woman of power suit is and lives in Mississippi and all of this stuff. But you cannot find what the male candidates wore to which event.
Yeah, it's a way of diminishing the person to deal with that sort of thing. And it goes back to, you know, how people are seen. But what Hillary Clinton did in 2008, she did have experience of 8 years as a senator, plus her life as a first lady both in Arkansas and in the United States. And she was able to raise the money. She had raised the money to in the Senate. And she was able. She was the first woman to win a state primary in New Hampshire. And she went on to win 22 more before she was defeated by Barack Obama. Evidently, in 2008, people were still convinced that a man who had less experience was more suited to lead than a woman. So here we are in 2016 with Hillary Clinton running again, and we'll see if the two major obstacles, money and the belief that men are more suited to leadership than women, that they have more stamina, they're less emotional, etc., etc. So if we can overcome those, a woman will win the nomination of the Democratic Party and run for general election for president.
And I will say that we are actually a divided group on who we're supporting personally. We're not electioneering or supporting any one candidate. We are encouraging you, though, when you are making those decisions at the ballot box, to take a step back and reflect that your decisions are not based on sexist criteria, and make sure that you're making your decisions based on policy and not stereotypes about emotionalness and qualifications of being female.
But I was going to comment that in several countries there have been women leaders who have done extremely well and put shame actually to the United States for our old-fashioned belief on women being inferior, I think.
And I think this does bring up the question of leadership in general. There are a lot of women who lead in their households or women who lead their own successful lives. And so the notion I think it's a fallacy to think that women are not leading or haven't been leading. It's just the ways in which we may feel more comfortable seeing women leading. But I personally, I'm not married or haven't been, but you can't tell me that the wives of the presidents haven't heavily influenced them, whether it was made extremely public or not. And just, you know, just in general, there is I believe a feminine and masculine quality to leadership. And just now we are maybe discussing the equality of the feminine side of leadership as a whole.
I think we need to bring Michelle Obama in and what she's done throughout too. Eight years of what she's been involved in and how she's just made so much more of a growth of children, adults, and just seeing her be active.
Well, I feel like it was Hillary Clinton that kind of led that new standard of what a first lady is and used that position as a position of power. But I was very young in the 90s, so I don't know if I have the correct impression of that.
I think that's true. I remember one time talking to some people at the election in 1992 of saying that Nancy Reagan was probably the past image of a first lady and that Hillary Clinton was the image of the future for first ladies, being a person and a professional in her own right.
Which I know Michelle Obama is, but I also, Hillary Clinton had a lot of initiatives, and Michelle Obama has had a lot of initiatives, and typically children, health, those types of things. Very much, I think, the path that Hillary Clinton paved for what a first lady can do with that position.
Thank you, Jane, for being our guest for 4 weeks successively and sharing with us about women's achievements.
Okay, thank you, and it's been a delight.
Thank you.
And we're going to take a station break, and we'll be back with Jonathan Rudy discussing women in peace.
The Pitch presents Crafts and Drafts, March 26th from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Uptown Shopping Center, 36th and Broadway, Kansas City, Missouri. There will be over 75 craft vendors and 25 beer purveyors on site. That's Crafts and Drafts, Saturday, March 26th, presented by The Pitch and sponsored by Tallgrass Beer, Crane Beer, Boulevard Brewing, and Cooper's Hawk Winery. Vendor applications and more information is available at pitch.com.
Jaws of Justice Radio welcomes Christy Childs, founder and director of Veronica's Voice, and Jamala Rogers, author of Ferguson is America. That's Jaws of Justice Radio, 9 a.m. Monday, right after Democracy Now!
And we are back, and Jonathan Rudy, the peacemaker in residence for Elizabethtown College's Center for Global Understanding and Peacemaking, as well as professor of peace and conflict studies. And John has additional titles too. Jonathan, senior advisor for human security with the Alliance for Peace Building. And you have more than 30 years of experience with peacemaking in 30 countries in Asia and Africa, and have extensive backgrounds as far as your education in religion and conflict transformation, and just your experiences in Africa, Asia, North America again, and so much information that you can share with us on your journey with women in those countries and what women can do, again, extending our conversation to lead, actually, maybe in some peacemaking efforts. We'd like to welcome you to Every Woman. And we're so glad that you could be in Kansas City, because you are, Jonathan does live in Pennsylvania, if you're wondering, Elizabethtown College. Fortunately, he was in Kansas City today, or in the area today, and can join us live in the studio. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you, Ebony. It's really a pleasure and a privilege to be here on this program. And I realize that, I, as a peacemaker, and I've done most of my work in Africa and Asia, I have met extraordinary women doing, changing their communities, inspiring me and holding my feet to the fire as a male, to be inclusive, but also to see in many of the contexts I worked in, their contexts of war, contexts of intense violence, and that really women are taking the brunt of this. And if you look around the table at any negotiation at these levels, you will find mostly men. If women and children are taking the brunt of some of these conflicts, why are those voices missing? I am very interested in what is called a conflict transformation framework, suggesting conflict is a normal part of the human experience. Mm-hmm. Out of that, we make choices. We make choices individually. We make them corporately in our communities. We make them nationally and structurally and culturally. Are we going to take the energies of conflict transform relationships into greater strengths, greater relationships, more trust? Or do we choose the methodologies of violence to kind of address those? And so conflict transformation suggests that if we take those and we harness those energies, we actually end up with stronger communities, better relationships. Mm. And so the women in my life who've taught me that, my wife, Carolyn, oh, believe it or not, 32 years of marriage, we know something about conflict and that on a relational level. And I'll tell you a little secret, but of course this is a 100,000-watt radio station, so it's not even a secret long. Carolyn actually does conflict better than I do. I study it. I teach it. I have been involved at a macro level, but at a relational level, my wife, Carolyn, when she gets in there with the kids, for example, when they were smaller, she really had an innate sense about how to be a non-anxious presence, one that allowed for dialogue, and I've learned a lot from her about that. So, we experience conflict on a personal level, and so it's persons like Carolyn who have really taught me a lot.
I like that you said just conflict being a part of our human experience, because sometimes I believe that, I know I have, and other people that I know have been afraid of conflict, like, oh my goodness, what do I do with this? Even if I've spoken out about it, it hasn't necessarily been in the most healthy way, of how do I deal with when I need to approach somebody, or I need to stand up for myself, or
well, and I think this is why I find myself in education, because yes, conflict can be immensely frightening, especially when we have conflict with a heavy component of violence. That is something that brings a lot of fear. And so education helps us to gain the capacities and skills necessary to actually move toward conflict and say, okay, so if there is this thing called conflict transformation, what do I need to do? Who do I need to be? What kind of capacities do I need to enhance in myself that will move me toward a transformational place? Mm-hmm. We do this in education, but it's not only, head knowledge. It is experimenting. It's, role plays and simulations whereby we get to test this stuff out. I've started working a lot with the U.S. military, believe it or not, as someone who's deeply committed to nonviolence and transformation. I find myself at this nexus where I'm engaging the military, And one of the things that I've been bringing into that is that I, as a transformed person, it doesn't matter who I'm meeting. These principles are very much needed and welcomed, and I'm finding them being welcomed at some really wonderfully strange places. And so,
I think something is working with two different kind of personalities. You just have to work guidance to not being so narrow-minded and showing the different areas you can kind of look into. Is that something?
Well, yeah, and so part of the way I understand conflict is it happens interpersonally. But we also realize that as humans we build organization, we build structure, and sometimes that violence or those divisive things are actually built in structurally. So if you look at nationally right now, we have a high level of angst among our mm-hmm. citizenry over yeah. this particular election. You know, what personal capacities do we need? What are the structural and even the cultural things that are part of reinforcing the place that we're in today? We didn't get to this kind of candidate and this kind of election based on two or three people. Mm-hmm. There is something collectively going on in this nation that even embeds itself culturally. I want to tell you a story of two women that I have worked with in the Philippines. A lot of my experience has been in the Philippines. I've engaged there since 2001. And it's where I first met Myla and Dang, two Catholic Relief Services staff people who had been working at the cyclical violence in Mindanao, the Philippines' largest southern island. Both of those women have a lifelong commitment to conflict transformation, working at community levels, personal levels, but also transforming the structures of that nation, the kind of things that would reinforce the conflict that was embedded in the society there. And so, in a sense, those two women, one of them, Myla, was actually part of the 1,000 Women for Peace, I think, that was submitted to the Nobel Peace Prize in 2005. Dang has been a trainer working with all levels of the conflict in the Philippines. And I've had the privilege of co-facilitating courses in peace building from them, learning a tremendous amount, being mentored by them and now colleagues of theirs. And it's women like that keep me going. I remember one time after another wave of the violence and displacement in Mindanao, I looked at my friend Dang and I said, I feel like giving up. She looked me in the eyes and she said, John, you don't have the privilege to do that. You can't do that. You cannot do that to me. And it was at that moment I realized, no, it's not an option. I have to keep working at this just as she has committed her life. If I give up on that, I'm giving up on her, and that we need each other to kind of continue to work at this.
Jonathan, with all the different people that you've worked with, do you think that we have a misunderstanding about peace? Or, you know, sometimes I wonder, do we really know what peace is? Like I could almost say most people say they want peace, but why does it seem so hard to find? Or why do we seem to have so little of it if it's something that we, for the most part, say we want?
Yeah, that's a great question. Let's see, how long do we have? Another 4 hours? Well, it is interesting because so I use the word peace building, right? There's peacemaking, peacekeeping. Peace building denotes the possibility, the reality that what we're working on here is a generational process. The problems we have now didn't just arise yesterday. Mm-hmm. If they did, they might be easier to fix. Mm-hmm. These are generational problems. Culture constructs itself. We construct culture over generations, over millennia. And so it takes the understanding that peace building is a long-term process, but at the same time addressing the immediate needs of peace. So one of the key elements of peace building is that we need to imagine. So what does it look like when guys like me are out of work? Mm-hmm. I'm working to get out of work, right? Mm-hmm. I want to go collect stamps or something. Do I have to go to these conflict zones to work at this? No. You know, in my idealized future, you know, guns are not necessary. Locks on doors are not necessary. It's not that we don't have conflict anymore, because conflict is actually the driver of change. Mm-hmm. But in that idealized world, we have capacities to take any differences and strengthen relationships, strengthen trust, and wind up with a greater capacity to deal with the next big thing that comes along. I think we have a failure of imagination in this country today, because the utility of violence has so embedded itself as the only way forward. Take ISIS, for example. Mm-hmm. We have a failure of imagination as to how to address that. And so we throw more drones and more bombs at it. But in reality, there are women on the ground in Syria. There are non-governments on the ground who are imagining the solutions here. And there's a disconnect between policy level in this country and in Europe and elsewhere. A disconnect between those voices who say, hey, I got ideas. Hey, over here. And the policymakers. This is where women come in. I have seen more of these conferences on Syria where there's one woman at the table, mm-hmm. and the rest of them policy level males who cannot imagine what grandmother might say in this context, the wisdom she might bring. So, anyways, Evan, you had that question, and I kind of danced around it.
Well, first, I mean, when I think about the expansion, I think of education. And from day one, when the children are learning, you've got to have someone who will show them that guns are not the way to go.
Right.
We have to use what we can teach them, and just so they're cutting back teaching, and they don't have schools.
Right. And we're teaching to testing, and you know, so you know, part of it is, again, imagination. What do our youth spend their time with? Imagining a world whereby everything is a first-person shooter. And I say, you know, can we imagine solutions? We tend to get what we practice, right? Mm-hmm. Dr. King understood this during the Civil Rights Movement, that you have to practice nonviolent direct action to challenge systems. And when we practice that, the military practices for the utility of violence regularly. They're disciplined about it. Where are we in the peace constituency practicing what it's like to engage those who disagree with us, to practice what it means to move toward trouble and intervene when things look like they're kind of imploding?
Does it require us to see ourselves differently? And I say that because I'm just saying, on a personal level, if I'm in a disagreement with someone, whether it be my sister, my mother, you know, just anything, it's like, does it require me to say, okay, I'm not really necessarily being threatened just because this other person disagrees, or nothing in particularly harmful is going to occur to me if I just hear them out, or like sometimes when people say, like, give to that other person what you want. Like, if I'm sitting here saying, I just want you to hear me, then stop and hear that other person. Where I don't feel like it's either me or you, you know, I win or you lose, or you win and or I lose, kind of that at a base level seems to be the, where we don't think there's enough space for both of us here.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, Ebony. I think we do need to kind of take a step back and maybe bring some different energy, if I can use that word here. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you a story. You know, I started my shift on, you know, my brother keeps telling me, John, you're a peacemaker because you don't have any inner peace. And so I grappled with that a long time. And I remember the day that began to shift. I was in a conversation with a woman who was very forceful on her political opinions, and I was probably equally forceful, I'll admit that, right? And I could see the temperature going up. I could see the escalation. And I said, I am so tired of this. I don't want this anymore. I'm going to try something different. And I just kind of, in this conversation, I just decided to just take a deep breath, open my heart. And I'm telling you that the escalation just evaporated. Mm-hmm. And we came to a place of such a different energy that I didn't have to prove anything. And then, therefore, she didn't have to prove anything. And I wonder sometimes if that's a different kind of place that we're being invited into right now. Mm-hmm. Why? Because if we add more fuel to the fire, it's just going to get hotter. Mm-hmm. We somehow need to kind of notch it back. Realize it's not an either or, it's a both and that's a different economy. Now you can get me going on, you know, the economy of abundance versus scarcity, and and this is all my students think I'm crazy because I bring all this stuff in. But
that you, just the point that you made though, when I used to really have this need to be right, and if my family members are listening, I don't know, some of them may argue I still have it, but. But I'm working. It's a practice, right, John? That's what you said.
Yeah, there you go.
But one of the turning points for me was when I heard somebody say, do you want to be right or do you want peace? And at one point, you know, I was like, maybe being right, I value that more. But then as I guess I mature a bit, having peace is more valuable to me than being right. And I realized that, well, everybody's right according to what they believe, you know, and so.
So that's a both and, so, not right. Just an either or. And it's coming to that ability to hold paradox and say, yes, and it doesn't diminish me at all if you differ from me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, and I think part of this comes with maturity. This is where the elders, how do we, culturally now, how have we built in the wisdom of elders to guide younger people in a way that says, okay, there's many ways to look at this, and part of that is a capacity.
I think to your point, that's still where we can look at conflict as something healthy and not necessarily a threat, because like you said, that's how we have change.
Yeah, and I think that you know, we've got to shift that a bit and be aware that there are some conflicts that are very dangerous and can be very destructive. So I think we have to learn kind of how to manage that as well.
I think you should, like, be able to go with the people and Donald Trump. Just get up there, get the Dalai Lama, get the Pope, and yourself, and kind of work with, in front of the people, say, now, look here.
I think that's out of my pay grade,
actually. I'll volunteer to do it.
we do have a caller on the line. Donna, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Donna. And I would love for your guest to expound on an idea that he mentioned, the economy of abundance versus the economy of scarcity that we're all sort of hypnotized into participating in right now. So if he could please talk about the economy of abundance.
Hi, Donna. Thank you. Thank you for that
Thank
question.
You.
It's kind of an experiment that I and many others, I think, have been working on. I will never forget a quote by Henry Ford when he said, think you can, think you can't. Either way, you're right. That concept of what is our attitude? So, this is actually a very big question. So it's so big, my brain just froze up. The economy of abundance goes back to some of like the potlatch cultures, and I don't know enough about those, just enough to be dangerous. But to say, you know, the more you circulate it, the more it comes back around. Whereas an economy of scarcity says, hey, there's a limited amount, zero sum, I better get mine. And of course, we live on a planet that we can exhaust resources. What's inexhaustible is the fact that there's enough for all. So do we have enough, or do we have, you know, is there always scarcity? And we have our economic system based on the fact that we have these insatiable needs and we got to keep feeding them. And the heresy, it is heresy to say, no, thank you, I have enough. My cell phone, even though it's 4 years old, works and it's okay. It's enough for me. That's moving into that economy that there is enough for all of us. There's not enough for our greed, but there's enough for our need.
Which would, just you saying that, Jonathan, makes me think of how for us, it makes me think of sacrifice, but in this, not in the sense of where we think, oh, if I give this up, there's not going to be, again, enough for me. But in the sense of, if I give this one thing up, then I may be open to a greater experience. Like kind of the, do I want to be right or do I want peace? If I give up my need to be right, then peace is actually more valuable. And it doesn't mean I'm right or wrong. It's just give this one thing up for something greater. But how we are in our society now, well, once you start talking about, oh, my cell phone is 4 years old, but it works pretty fine. It's enough. I could hear some of the cell phone makers saying, whoa, 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 whoa. If you start saying stuff like that, then I can't sell a new cell phone every year or every, you know what I mean? Then
I do. And our entire system is based on that. And therefore, it will exploit who and what it has to get those minerals to make that new cell phone. And we do know that many of those very rare elements come from the mines in Congo or some very, very desperate places where that stuff is pretty valuable. And that is part of a structural violence that exists in the world. And when we do talk about peace, we need to talk about how all of that connects. You know, if I can give you my one sentence definition of peace building, it's reconnecting that which has been disconnected by violence. Mm. And when you begin to reconnect things, connect where our food is produced with the way in which we eat it, the appreciation, the soil. When you connect all of those things, you come into this unlimited world, this unlimited universe that wants to kind of conspire to organize to put things together. And I think these economies, it's been something, a model I've been working with and seeing, does it work in real life? And mm-hmm. and for many, it has worked for me. Would it work on a macro scale? I don't know. Let's try it. Nobody's ever done it that way.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I take that back. There are communities, open source communities, community level initiatives, bike sharing, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. that are moving and experimenting with all of that.
In your travels and your studies, who do you look to as maybe a country or a group or an area that seems to be peace building at a really great rate that we can, you know, some sort of a elder brother or sister, if you will, that we can look up to?
Well, in the civil military dialogues, I've been involved for since 2001, and those dialogues have actually worked into a structural level. So, you know, when we talk about relationships, it's one thing to have transformed relationships, but if they're not transforming our structures, then we need to keep working at them and find ways in which policy is actually shaped. And back to the Philippines, our training military officers in the peace building is a few years ahead of where we are here in the U.S. with that. But, you know, you look to a nation like Costa Rica without a military. They have, of course, a police. But you know, I sat beside a military officer in Tanzania, flying from Tanzania one time, and I asked him, so does Tanzania have any mortal enemies? Well, no, not really. I said, so why do you have such a big military? And that's a blind spot. Why do we need all these weapons? Why do we need nuclear weapons in an age like this? Why can't we just dismantle them? And, of course, I understand some of the ramifications of saying that. But You know, why do we produce on this planet enough ammunition to kill every person on the planet twice?
You know? Yeah, I think we have 7,000 nuclear weapons. How many does it take to destroy the planet?
Yeah, and they're expensive. One of the things is that, so violence promises a utility it simply cannot deliver, right? Nothing that violence has ever promised has been delivered without creating a brand new host of problems. And so we get to the point where we sag under the burden, the economic burden of maintaining these weapons systems. I look at my students and I say, so do you want a new aircraft carrier or do you want free higher education for a year or two or four? Mm-hmm. And they never put that together. They don't connect that. So there's something, you know, that's peace building. That's connecting.
As a member of the American Friends Service Committee, I happen to know for a fact, because I was just at a meeting Tuesday night, 57% of our disposable budget, discretionary budget, I should say, and it is disposed of, goes to the military. And there seems to be an insatiable need for the corporate citizens that are making the money from the military to maintain this military might, so to speak.
Yeah.
And how do we as citizens, what can we do to convince them we don't want this?
Well, and part of it is to be civically engaged. But I will say that as I've began civil military kind of conversations, and I'm very early in that in the U.S., I'm finding many officers are recognizing the limitations when they are sent out, that they need to engage in the civil society around them, in the civic organizations, because there's tremendous capacity there to actually do things much cheaper, much more efficiently, and even much more sustainably than if you bring in a big outside force. And they're recognizing that, and I think that's the level of conversation in this country that's increasing.
So our military leaders may be the hope for ending some of this atrocious spending when people's needs aren't being met on the ground in the United States.
Yes, there are some of them that I'm engaging in, yes, are very aware of what's going on there. So,
though I can hear people saying, you know, well, look at what just happened in Brussels. And look at, you know, this is not a time to cut back in military spending because someone can just attack us and we need to be able to fight back. And, you know, there's the talk about we need to have a tough approach and things like, and maybe having an imagination or, you know, extending hands are considered weakness by some. But the thing is to your point of practicing things that work, it becomes a matter of really wanting to step back and say, does this work? We have been doing it this way, and does this work? Okay, and Sharon's raising her hand.
Yes, you know, the USA, the good old USA, making enemies faster than we can kill them. I mean, that's what I think we're doing. I mean, we need a different approach.
But does it, John, does it start with, I have a strong feeling about this, like sometimes I was really looking at the TV this week with Brussels, and I said, you know, but what part do I play in this, you know, and like, how can I respond? And sometimes I think I used to feel as though, well, this argument or this unforgiveness I'm holding with my sister doesn't matter. But it's like, isn't things like this the same small thing on a bigger scale, though? You know, it's like holding unforgiveness for your sister or brother, it's the same thing, it's just on a bigger scale.
It is, and that's where it's all connected. So the hatred we harbor in our own hearts gets translated ultimately into our culture. And we create the systems of hatred and the systems that then lack imagination. One of the things that I'm acutely aware of is that when I've experienced violence, or that there is violence, a prevalence of violence, it really diminishes our capacity for imagination. So one of the key tasks in areas where we work at peace building is to refire the imagination and to say, okay, so So what do we do here? And that best happens at a community level, at a personal level. When I take on the structural ills of the world, I get quickly deflated, and it's like, oh man, what can I possibly do? Yeah. And some of the most tangible and practical things to do are the personal things. What does it take to release the hatred, to transform that into a love and into a moving toward?
I just thought of a song from Unity, Let There Be Peace and Let It Begin With Me.
And in
so doing that, we're also increasing our relational capacity with those directly around us. And then the next layer out is our communities. And then we have greater capacity. If things start to get tense on the streets, we have a cohesion whereby leaders already have good relationships and they talk with each other. And I've seen this for example, in Indonesia, where after a series of riots in the community, community leaders recognize we're all losers here when this happens. And so community leaders got together and said, okay, across all of the diversity that we have, religion and ethnicities and business and civic leaders, we can form a capacity to intervene directly when we see the temperature of our community rising. We'll get out there. You know, that's happening in this country on 1,000 different points and places. It's happening here. It just doesn't get reported on. And, you know, these concepts of nonviolent change, they're all over the place. We know how to do this as a nation. And maybe we just need more people to encourage us and to pat us on the back and say, yes, we're doing the right thing here.
You kind of have to have the be able to control the trickle-down effect and work with the environment and work with the people who are in charge, it seems like, in the different communities and the states are where I'm at.
And you do bring up an important point. For a long time, we have not, in the peace-building field, environment, we've understood that there are resource conflicts and that kind of thing. But what we're finding now is that the very way in which we treat the land, the very way in which we treat the natural world around us reflects on us. You know, it reflects on our capacity to manage change and to do so constructively, and that it's a critical piece now. The other thing that the peace builders have been neglect in a long time is the business community. There's a tremendous amount of resources there, and it's actually good for business. Peace is good for business. There's only a handful of people that war is good for.
Now, that makes me think of a comment this week on The View. Ben Carson was on, and Whoopi was just talking about, she was visibly in angst about how he could support Donald Trump, and she just couldn't reconcile it. And he said something to the effect of, where does it get you to be nice and, you know, and talk about the important issues and the, I guess be respectful? He said, no, it gets you where it got me, nowhere. And so he kind of made the case for, maybe in a way, why being the nice guy, I guess, if you will, or the one who's more calm, doesn't work. But then another person brought up the point, well, now President Barack Obama didn't, you know, he was ran a more respectable race, if you will, comparatively, and he was able to win. But I think sometimes we think, well, peace doesn't work. Like, it's not going to get me where I really want to be.
And I think, so part of this is, with imagination comes hope. And we have to kind of hang in there and say, well, maybe we're not going to see a lot of results here. I want to tell you one more story. Do we have time for another story here?
Yeah.
So a few years ago, I did a project for Oxfam, a major British humanitarian organization in Afghanistan. And it was the spring offensive from the Taliban, and they attacked Kabul. And I happened to be in Kabul about a mile from one of the major battles. And here I am working as a peace builder in Afghanistan with a major battle going on. And I thought, so what use am I? What use am I in the middle of this where hard power is being lobbed at, you know, lobbed and people are shooting at each other? And it was about 2:30 in the morning when the fighting started up again. And I've started to get really fearful. And I got on Skype with my brother in Kansas. And I said, Paul, I'm starting to freeze up with fear here. And he said, hey, I have a friend, Lana Marie Haas, who lives as a musician in Lawrence. He said, listen to this SoundCloud file. And it was a little song called We Live in Peace, We Live in Harmony. And it's a very simple yet clear affirmation. And it goes, we live in peace, we live in harmony, and over again. And I listened to that song in Afghanistan from somebody right here in the heartland. And I'm telling you, I fell asleep in the middle of that fighting. I had inner peace. And before I did so, I opened my heart to the soldiers doing the fighting. Now, Ebony, I don't know what that did. I don't know what it contributed. But I do know that personally, it gave me a completely different kind of energy, and it allowed me to be that guy who now had found peace. And it didn't matter the external circumstances. Mm. And there I was, and that's what I contributed. I don't know what it was that I contributed.
I think that's a great story. And before we leave here, I want to tell how Ebony connected. Ebony, tell how you connected with...
Oh, with Jonathan.
Yes.
Well, we were both at, and Jonathan and his brother, Paul Rooney, were at the Kemper Museum for an event. And Jonathan was, I think you were sitting first. Yes, I met you first before Paul. Jonathan was sitting down, and I was looking for a seat. And it was a space next to him open, and I sat there, and his brother came along, and the three of us started talking and had a great conversation. And
how long ago was that?
Last October, was it?
Somewhere, yeah. Yeah, last year. So it hasn't been that long at all. So I'm so glad we can connect and reconnect.
And there is serendipity here.
It is.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Jonathan, for spending part of your time visiting your brother here in Kansas with us on the radio show. And
thank you, Ebony and Sharon, for inviting me.
Thank you. And for all of you tuning in online at kkfi.org and listening to Every Woman, we appreciate you tuning in and listening. And we'll see you back here next Saturday at 3 o'clock. And please stay tuned for Urban Connections with Donna Wolf and Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City with MC Richardson. Have a great weekend, everybody.